Thanks, everyone, for being here. My name is Jamel Russell, and I think it's only appropriate, I wasn't going to do this, but just to take a moment to acknowledge the people of Ferguson right now. The armed guard has landed there. And to acknowledge all the people who have fallen victims to police crime in our country and around the world. I personally today would like to dedicate my presentation to my friend who was killed by the police in 2003, Jamal Bonner. His parents sued the Colorado Police Department and won. So the United States has the highest incarceration rate in the entire world, as we heard already today. And we are here in Louisiana, the capital of prison. There are currently over 350 people serving life here for nonviolent crimes. Those crimes include things like stealing gas, shoplifting, or selling a dime bag of marijuana. And they're able to serve life in prison because of the three strike rules. So, when we think about prison, they are increasingly becoming privatized. Currently in the United States, 18% of prisons are privately owned. So that means because states have to pay so much money to maintain them, the Corrections Corporation of America is saying, hey, we'll buy your prison from you. But when they do that, that means that they have to maintain 90 to 95% occupancy, no matter if the crime rate in that state declines. And this is a quote from the CFO. He says, our business touches so many things: security, medicine, education, food service, maintenance, technology, that it presents a unique opportunity for any number of vendors to do business with us. And when you read that, you think, you know, he's talking about some nonprofit that's aimed to help people. But instead, they are collaborating with different organizations, such as McDonald's, for people to make things in prison. But this is not what I want to talk to you about today. I just wanted to share that a little bit. I'd like to present to you a more fundamental theory about how race has been used as a political tool throughout history to divide us and to have social control and to conquer. These techniques allow the 1% to control the 99% and monopolize on our labor. So that was what I just said on this slide. So has race always existed? So as you can see right there, 1600 is when we can trace back to when race was first used in the United States. But if, according to the historian Lenore Bennett, he says that Africans, Portuguese, Spaniards, and Englishmen were all living in the United States before the Mayflower touchdown in 1620. So at that time, there was no such thing as black or white. That only came to fruition when the Africans and the indentured workers joined forces. There were also Native Americans that joined forces with them to oppose the ruling class, who were levying unfair taxes, appointing their friends to high positions, and not providing sufficient protection for them on the borders. So they joined forces to oppose the ruling class, and when that happened, the ruling class became very fearful, and their reaction to that was to create a more harsh racial slavery caste system, where they made it illegal to interact with someone of the quote-unquote other race. And if you were caught interacting with someone from another race, that could be, you could be killed for that. So, we continue to see these forms of social control throughout our society. And this photo I got from the University of Pennsylvania. It was a demonstration that was happening that basically, I feel like, sums up a little bit of the systems of control that have been used. That the slavery caste system gave way to Jim Crow, which has now given way to mass incarceration. And in Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Time of Colorblindness, she accounts for the first time that she heard about this. She saw it on a radical poster for a group in California, and the sign said, the new Jim Crow is the war on drugs. And she thought, oh, that's a little absurd to make that comparison. If anyone saw me going to this meeting, that would be crazy. You know, the prison system is racist, but to equate that to Jim Crow, that's a little extreme, she thought. But while she was in law school and changed her focus to social justice, she actually began to unravel this new tax system, and she came out with her book. So you can see, I'm not getting it. So, but you can see that the imprisonment rate, this was imprisonment rate from 1925 to 1972, and you can see that it was a little over 300,000 around 1940. And going into 1972, we were at the lowest point that we have been in our nation's history that we can account for. However, when you look at this graph here from 1925 to 2007, you can see in 1965, when a lot of policies were enacted, that the war on drugs, you can see an increase in imprisonment rates. So I just also wanted to show the amount of in 1970. Once again, the incarceration rates and the spike, but also the correlation between black and white individuals that were arrested for drug-related arrests. And although white youth use and sell drugs at a higher rate, it is African-American youth that are experiencing higher levels of juvenile detention. And they're coming down very hard with this, and we're seeing that in our school-to-prison pipeline. Urban schools are facing a lack of resources, and with the incentivized No Child Left Behind, which gives schools funding for high test scores, it has led them to incorporate these zero-tolerance policies that pretty much gets rid of the bad app, quote-unquote bad apples of the school so that they can maintain high test scores. So what the schools, what they have done to do that is enact policies such as the zero tolerance policy, where you can get sent to, you can get handcuffed in school for things like talking back, disruptive behavior, or even sagging. So minor offenses that used to send you to the principal's office can now have you in prison for a misdemeanor, such as writing on a desk. The schools are employing what they call resource officers. A lot of them have no youth training, and because of that, they're seeing more arrests in the school. A lot of the students are getting placed in handcuffs at school for things like graffiti, ditching class. The U.S. Department of Education released its 2011-2012 report that shows the racial disparities in public schools are very troubling, and that African American youth are experiencing a higher rate of suspension in preschool. The youngest victim of this was 2 years old to be handcuffed.
What?
So why do we keep seeing racial oppression coming back, but just in different forms? And we have to look at our history. That tells us everything. Throughout history, there has always been a ruling class whose main goal is to maintain power and make money. Focusing on one group sends a message to the population that you could be next. It's the strategy of targeted terror. It's expensive to arrest and lock up everyone. It's easier to focus on one group, and throughout our history, those people have been black and brown people. Basically, the main objective is to divide and conquer. If we can hate one another, we're easier to control. Lyndon Johnson has a very candid quote that I feel like sums all of this up. He says, I'll tell you what is at the bottom of this. If you can convince the lowest white man that he's better off than the best colored man, he won't notice you picking his pocket. Hell, he'll give him someone to look down on and he'll empty his pockets for you. So let's take an economic look at this super exploitation. This is an economic view of how African American labor is used for profit. So you have 19 million African Americans that are currently within the working age population. In 1974, African Americans made $12,770 less than their white counterparts. In 2005, they made $14,481 less. So what does that mean? If you multiply that, corporations are able to save $275 billion by paying less. But that just doesn't affect African Americans. It also affects white individuals. There's 129 million white U.S. people that work within that age population. And because they're able to drive African Americans' wages so low, that also affects the white worker. They experience a 10% reduction in their wages as well. So if you multiply that, that's $518 billion that a corporation can save per year. So the results of this, the economic results of this are wage differentials, and the ways that African Americans and other minorities experience this is by living in poverty. When you get paid less in this economy, it's very hard to live. And for white workers, it is the implicit threat of replacement because someone else could do the job that and they'll take less pay. The social effect of this is an establishment of a security state. There's more incarceration in our country, and we're seeing increased police terror. Basically, black workers are being locked up at a higher rate than any other individuals, or they're just being shot dead. The extensive effect for this for white workers is that it can give them someone to look down on, like Lyndon Johnson mentioned, or it kind of gives them the idea that this could be me. So what are some future trends that we would see? We have a lot of communities that are on the brink of another Ferguson, like the people living in Michigan, the black and brown people that are still without water. Basically, one way to end this is to have more unity and realize that it affects everyone. This woman in the sign is holding up a sign that says, "And then they came for me," which was a quote that a pastor in Nazi Germany said before he died in a concentration camp. And I'd just like to read that. He says, "First they came for the socialists, and I did not speak out because I was not a socialist. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me. Thank you."